Hey there. Before we get into today's episode, I have a quick favor to ask. If you love this show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us. It really helps other people find us, and it helps us know what you're liking and want to hear more of. Thank you. On with the show. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how forever chemicals have poisoned the world. For most of his life, Michael Hickey never saw himself as an activist.
He's an insurance underwriter. He has a fear of public speaking.
That's investigative journalist Mariah Blake.
He had no interest in environmental issues. He had no interest in politics. He liked to joke that he got his news from ESPN.
Then in 2010, his father was diagnosed with an aggressive kidney cancer and died a few years later at the age of 70. Michael was devastated, and he started to think about how this could have happened and about some of the other deaths in their small town of Hoosick Falls, New York.
Everyone in the community had stories of people who had died young of cancer, and there seemed to be extraordinarily high rates of rare cancers and aggressive cancers.
Michael began to suspect that these deaths had something to do with the local Teflon factory, where his father had worked for many years.
So I typed Teflon and cancer into Google, and he called up this large health study that had taken place in West Virginia, and it showed that this particular chemical called PFOA, it's a type of forever chemical, had been linked to kidney cancer.
He worried that the town's drinking water might be contaminated with this chemical, and he tried to get local authorities to test the water, but he wasn't getting anywhere.
Michael eventually ordered a testing kit, and he tested the water himself, and it turned out that, yes, the drinking water had very high levels of this chemical PFOA in it.
PFOA is a type of PFAS, which is the name for a broad group of synthetic chemicals, often called forever chemicals, because of how long they take to break down. For Michael and his community, many were being exposed to high levels of PFAS, but they're also, to a lesser degree, in so many household goods. Things that we all use every day, from food wrappers to cleaning products to shampoo. In her new book, They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals, Mariah takes a deep and expansive look at this class of compounds. And listen, I know what you might be thinking. This feels huge, inescapable even. But stick around and Mariah will tell you why she has a lot of hope for the future, thanks to activism from people like Michael. And she offers some practical tips on what you can do right now to protect yourself and your family from exposure. I started by asking Mariah to explain what exactly forever chemicals are.
Forever chemicals, or PFAS, they are a large family of chemicals with some really amazing properties. So they're incredibly resistant to heat, to stains, to water, to grease, to electrical currents. They stand up to caustic chemicals that destroy virtually all other materials, and that makes them extremely useful. So these chemicals have really ushered in space travel, high-speed computing. They have really opened the outdoors to ordinary Americans as a result of waterproof clothing like Gore-Tex. Mm-hmm. And they've transformed thousands of everyday items from clothing to furniture to dental floss. Anything you have in your home that is nonstick or waterproof or grease resistant, you know, a lot of packaging in restaurants, all of those things contain these chemicals. Mm. On the other hand, they are probably the most insidious pollutant in all of human history. So we're talking about a class of chemicals that are highly toxic, even in minuscule doses. They stay in the environment for hundreds or even thousands of years. I've actually seen an internal industry document that estimated the half-life for one of these chemicals was a million years.
Oh my God, that's shocking.
So we're talking a timeline that's more akin to nuclear waste than to ordinary chemicals. And they are literally polluting the entire planet. So they are in the blood of basically every living being. They are polluting ecosystems in the remotest parts of the world. No place on Earth is free of these chemicals.
Wow. I was about to ask, I mean, how does it end up in our bodies?
The main way most people are exposed is through food. And it's also in drinking water, and there are communities with highly contaminated drinking water. And for people living in those communities, that is generally the main source of exposure. But we're also exposed to it through consumer goods because it's in thousands of everyday items, from diapers to lipstick to kitty litter, carpet, furniture, Band-Aids. All of our homes are filled with these chemicals. And it's not a problem we can shop our way out of. Our individual choices make a difference to a certain degree, but none of us can avoid these chemicals entirely.
Mm. And the fact that they are in the blood of almost every person on the planet now, I mean, what do we understand about what they do to our body?
So the highest levels of exposure, there's six diseases in particular: kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis, which is a degenerative bowel disease, pregnancy, hypertension, and thyroid disease. Those six conditions were linked to the best studied of these chemicals back in the 2000s. Mm. Now, since then, there's been a huge volume of data linking them to other health problems like obesity, reduced IQ, immune suppression, infertility, problems with neurological development. And some of these health effects are seen at very, very low levels of exposure, ordinary population levels of exposure. So many of us are carrying levels in our blood that have the potential to be harmful. Mm. And I think the other thing that's interesting, so this is a class of 9,000 substances, but every single one that has been studied has been shown to cause at least some of the same health effects as, you know, the two that are best known and most studied. And in fact, the EPA has concluded they have set what they call a health-based drinking water standard for PFOA and PFOS, two of the best known PFAS, and that standard is zero. So the EPA has essentially determined that no level of exposure to these two chemicals in particular is safe.
Mm. Let's talk about the creation of PFAS, because I understand that this was a U.S. government initiative. How did they go from being a government-backed wartime innovation, it sounds like, to something that ended up being used in so many consumer products?
Well, I'd like to just pause for a second and talk about the significance of the fact that these chemicals were created by the U.S. government. So most people don't realize that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that was one of the most surprising things I discovered in the course of my research. So PFAS were developed by the U.S. government as part of the top secret Manhattan Project.
You may remember hearing about the Manhattan Project in history class. It was a secret U.S. government program to develop the first nuclear weapons during World War II. But Mariah says there are aspects of this program that many of us still don't know much about.
There was this secret chemistry program, very similar to the secret program that was used to develop nuclear fuels, that was completely focused on developing this class of chemicals.
The government needed a material that would allow them to handle and work with a caustic substance needed for uranium enrichment. That material is what we now know as forever chemicals.
These massive plants that were used to enrich uranium, they all, basically everything, had to be coated in PFAS.
As the Manhattan Project workers were making these chemicals, it was clear that they were incredibly toxic and dangerous.
Explosions and fires were commonplace. Workers were regularly being hospitalized with chemical burns and breathing problems. Farmers downwind of the plants, their peaches started dying, their animals, you know, some of the cows were so sick that they couldn't walk. They laid on their bellies and grazed.
When farmers started raising concerns, Manhattan Project scientists began studying the health effects of these chemicals and found that they were toxic and accumulating in human blood. But this information was buried, and it wasn't long before these chemicals started showing up in everyday products.
After the war, a company called 3M, which is based in Minnesota, they acquired a patent to produce PFAS, and they hired Manhattan Project scientists to help develop them into chemicals that could be used in consumer goods. And from there, you know, they found more and more uses because it had these properties that no other substances had.
Mariah's reporting shows that early on, 3M, as well as other manufacturers like DuPont, were aware that these chemicals were harmful.
So as early as the 1960s, they knew that they were toxic. By the 1970s, DuPont and 3M were aware that these chemicals were accumulating in the blood of people all over the United States, and they would later find that this was true all over the world. So the blood data triggered this flurry of research on the health effects, and industry discovered that they had devastating effects on lab animals. So one of the early studies involved monkeys. And the study had to be aborted early because all of the monkeys died.
Oh, my God.
And so during the same period, these companies began testing the effects of these chemicals on their own workers.
Uh-huh.
And those studies also yielded very troubling findings. So they found connections to kidney cancer, to leukemia, to prostate cancer, to organ damage, to immune suppression. But I think the most shocking of all was what was called the pregnancy outcome study. So in the 1980s, DuPont began monitoring the pregnancies of workers in its Teflon factories because PFOA had been found to cause severe facial birth defects in mice. And two of the seven women who gave birth during that period gave birth to children who had serious facial deformities, similar to the ones found in mice. Mm. So DuPont concluded that this was a statistically significant excess.
Right.
But rather than informing the public or workers, they just killed the study. And that wouldn't come to light until many years later.
And just to say, you reached out to 3M and DuPont for comment.
Yes.
3M pointed out their efforts to phase out PFAS, and DuPont distanced themselves from the actions of previous company owners.
Yeah.
But to go back to these studies that you're talking about, I mean, at the time that they were happening, where were regulators in all of this?
Regulators didn't know any of this was happening because under our regulatory system, chemicals are presumed safe until proven otherwise. And, you know, the laws governing food safety and chemical safety both grandfathered in all chemicals that were in existence before the laws were enacted. So they never got any scrutiny.
Wow.
You know, and the only reason regulators and scientists even know these chemicals exist is because of this humble family of West Virginia farmers.
Yeah, tell me this story. This came about in the 90s, it sounds like.
So this family, they lived near a DuPont plant in Parkersburg, West Virginia. And at some point, DuPont purchased some acreage adjoining their farm for a landfill. And after that, their cows started sprouting tumors and vomiting blood. Some of them went blind. And pretty soon, the cows were dying faster than they could bury them. They lost more than 100 cows. So they were convinced that the landfill was to blame, and so they sued DuPont. And their case ended up exposing this breathtaking cover-up involving PFOA. So there was a class action lawsuit that followed their lawsuit. So as part of the settlement, DuPont agreed to fund a study on the health effects of these chemicals among people in Parkersburg who had been drinking them in their water because the local water supply was also polluted.
Mm.
69,000 residents participated in that study. And that is how scientists were able to establish the link between these chemicals and those six diseases I mentioned earlier. And at that point, that set off this flurry of scientific research. And, you know, the lawyer who had represented the farmers actually sent all of these internal documents that he had collected to the EPA and began hounding the EPA to take action. But they were very slow to act.
Why? I mean, what are some of the real reasons why the EPA wouldn't be quick to respond here or act?
Well, it's partially because its authority to regulate chemicals is extremely weak. Asbestos is the example many people point to. It's been trying to regulate asbestos since the 1980s and
right.
hasn't actually managed to effectively do so because its authority is so weak and industry uses litigation to block regulation.
Mm.
I mean, there's also other factors, which is, you know, the revolving door. So there's people who work at the highest ranks of industry, oftentimes, you know, toggle back and forth between industry jobs and jobs in government. Those industry jobs are much more lucrative. Industry lobbyists are paying a lot more attention to what's happening in these regulatory agencies than almost anyone else, right? They have the resources.
Right.
And a lot of what happens has to do with obscure regulatory rules that most people don't think about.
Hmm. Well, so let's go back to the story of Michael Hickey and Hoosick Falls, because this is a pretty recent example of average citizens exposing the harms of forever chemicals and really getting results. So Michael, he got the water tested. He got more people involved. What did they do to keep sounding the alarm?
They did everything they could think of, you know. So they spoke out in the media, and their stories were incredibly compelling. Michael talked about the agony of his father's death.
Why I pushed so hard was because of really who my dad was, you know, not only to our family, but to the people in Hoosick Falls as well. And I've kind of tried to follow what I thought that he would want me to do during this entire process.
And there was this beloved local doctor, Marcus Martinez, who in the very early stages, while they were trying to get the mayor to test the drinking water, he was diagnosed with cancer in his early 40s.
Through my practice and living in the community for over 40 years, it seemed like we always had a great number of cancers, and our cancer incidence also seemed to be higher, out of proportion for our small community.
Another woman named Emily Marpe, she was working class. She had spent years saving to buy her dream home and then learned that her private well was extremely contaminated and her family had astronomical blood levels, so on par with DuPont factory workers.
I've lived in that house 4.5 years, and I'm comparable to people who have worked with it for 28 years, 23 years. And this isn't leaving my body tomorrow. This isn't leaving me for 15 to 30 years. When my daughter decides to have children, will she have them? Will they be born with birth defects?
So I think their stories were incredibly powerful, but they also, you know, they protested and in front of the state house, they met with lawmakers, they went to Washington over and over again, they testified before Congress, they filed lawsuits, they ran for public office.
And this fight went on for more than a decade, right? I mean, I know that you spoke to these folks for years. What were they able to ultimately accomplish?
Well, I mean, they accomplished a lot of things. So New York State became the first to regulate PFOA. They designated it a hazardous substance, which means that the state can force the polluters to investigate the scope of pollution and clean up the pollution. They also set some of the toughest drinking water standards in the country. So there are a number of laws that passed, but the community also, Michael Hickey was one of the lead plaintiffs on this groundbreaking lawsuit that established medical monitoring for the community. So people who have been exposed to this chemical, they'll go for regular checkups so that any diseases are caught early when they're most treatable. Hmm. And there's also substantial financial compensation, more substantial than any other community has, you know, in a similar situation has gotten at this point in time. But there were also just a lot of concessions that were won through negotiations between the state and the companies involved. So, for example, very recently, Hoosick Falls got a new water supply. So in most communities where there's contaminated drinking water, they put filtration on the existing wells. Those filters, most of those systems are not effective for the entire class of chemicals. So in Hoosick Falls, they tapped into an entirely different aquifer that is not contaminated. I mean, it's been really remarkable because when the contamination hit, it was a crisis for the community, not just the contamination, but the stigma. You know, at some point, banks quit giving out mortgages. People couldn't buy or sell homes. Property values plummeted. But it's been interesting to see as the drinking water is addressed, you also see this turnaround in the community where it's now undergoing an economic renaissance. New businesses are springing up downtown. People are more politically engaged than they were before. So only 54 people voted in the election before before the contamination was discovered. And the most recent election, it was much higher than that. So a lot of people have turned into more engaged citizens because they had spent their whole life trusting that there were systems in place to protect them. And that, you know, that trust was shattered.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because I actually talked to the mayor the day they turned on the new water supply. And he told me that one resident came up to him and crying and gave him a hug and said, "This is how government's supposed to work."
Hmm. Yeah. And they had an impact on the federal level, too, right? I mean, I was reminded of this, actually, by your recent reporting in the New York Times. And you wrote about how in 2017, Trump had nominated someone to lead the EPA. His name was Michael Dorson, who was, I guess, some kind of industry official. And there was a lot of pushback against his nomination, so much so that the nomination was ultimately withdrawn, right?
Yes. So he was not an industry official. He was a scientist who was largely funded by industry. And his work was essentially used to defend dangerous products. So, yes. And the amazing thing was, while I was following this Hoosick Falls story, which, you know, I followed these people in Hoosick Falls for 8 years.
Yeah.
But as I was following them, people all across the country started learning their drinking water was contaminated. And a lot of them, you know, and we're talking people, Republicans, Democrats, an incredible variety of people, firefighters, housewives, farmers, they started turning to advocacy too. And so you had this grassroots movement that was arising. And the first real sign of its power was this fight over Dorson's nomination, because people from affected communities descended on Washington. And after that, Republicans started coming out against this scientist's nomination, and he was forced to withdraw. So that was really remarkable at that point in time. And since then, they've just continued to score victories. So firefighters, I think, are a really interesting example. Firefighters, their gear contains very high levels of PFAS. And this only came to light because the wife of a firefighter sent gear into a lab to be tested. So this variations of the same story play out again and again, where it's ordinary citizens taking the initiative. And then the firefighting foam that they use, there's a specialized firefighting foam that also includes high levels. So, and they have high rates of the associated cancer. So the number one cause of death among firefighters is cancer. So one of the things they've fought for is bans on PFAS in firefighting foam. We now have those in 15 states, you know, largely as a result of firefighters. But in some places, firefighters are also advocating for bans on PFAS in consumer products, right? And they're a very powerful force just because people have so much respect for them. You know, they span partisan lines. You know, similar things are happening in communities all across the country. And so at this point, right now, 30 U.S. states have passed a total of, I think, 120 laws on PFAS, including 14 full or partial bans on these chemicals and consumer products. And this is hugely important because once there are these bans, industry then has to go through their supply chain and figure out where these chemicals are. And once that information is out there, it's such a liability that they are eager to get them out of their products.
Where is the EPA today, under the current Trump administration? How does the current head of the EPA think about PFAS? I understand it's Lee Zeldin.
Yeah.
I used to live in New York. That's a name that I'm familiar with as a congressman from Long Island, he used to be.
Yeah. So this is actually very interesting. So Lee Zeldin represents Long Island, or represented Long Island when he was in Congress. Long Island, the district that he represented, has extreme PFAS contamination.
Sure.
And right. So there were a lot of Republicans that, beginning around 2019, became vocal advocates of regulating these chemicals. And Lee Zeldin was among them. So he was calling on the EPA to set drinking water standards. He was sponsoring aggressive legislation. And during his confirmation hearing, he promised to make this one of his top priorities.
When I was in the House, I was a member of the PFAS Task Force, also voted for the PFAS Action Act. So working with all of you to deal with these issues in your home state is something that will be top priority of mine.
Recently, the EPA unveiled this plan. They described it as major actions to combat PFAS contamination. And I think, you know, people who follow this issue closely feel like it might just be cover for delays. So a similar thing happened under the first Trump administration, where they talked about aggressively addressing PFAS contamination, but they didn't really. And in fact, one detail is of particular concern to environmental groups. There's some language in the statement that suggests that they may, you know, through this obscure procedural channel, move to preempt state laws. That would mean the laws that are already on the books would remain, but states would be barred from taking future action. And states have really led on this. So that would be a big problem if it came to fruition. I mean, it's far from clear how exactly this will play out. But it's definitely not as clear-cut as most environmental issues. As the way the Trump administration is handling this is more nuanced than, you know, than virtually any other regulatory issue.
Earlier this week, the EPA announced action on this issue, a partial rollback of Biden-era drinking water standards for PFAS, keeping strict limits on two types of forever chemicals, PFOA and PFOS, but rescinding and reconsidering the rules for four other compounds. It also extended the deadline for water utilities to comply from 2029 to 2031. In a statement announcing the change, EPA head Zeldin said the agency would continue to protect Americans while providing, quote, common sense flexibility in the form of additional time for compliance. Mariah pointed out that the four chemicals in question have been shown to have similar negative health effects to PFOA and PFOS. She called this move by the Trump administration a reversal of a major public health victory. And she said that it will cause millions of Americans to lose protections against PFAS. But she remains optimistic because of the progress she sees on the state level.
So right now, there are 200 bills that have been introduced in state legislatures that would restrict the use of these chemicals. And a lot of them are in red states. So Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, you know, some of these red states are weighing consumer product bans, Montana, for example. And there's this huge wave of litigation against manufacturers. So there's more than 15,000 lawsuits. And those two factors combined have changed the sort of economic equation in a way that is really causing a lot of companies to reconsider whether they actually want to use these chemicals. And I think the clearest example of that is that 3M, which has been the main manufacturer of PFAS since the 1950s, has announced that it is going to phase them out by the end of this year.
What do you make of that? Does that feel significant? Should people trust that pledge?
I mean, there are caveats, but I do think it's real. And I mean, 3M has committed to paying out $10 billion in damages so far. So the reason it made this choice is because investors are calling on it to get out of the market because of the liability, the legal liability, and also, you know, all these state-level laws. But it's not just 3M. So 40 major retail chains with $1.7 trillion in combined annual sales have pledged to reduce or eliminate PFAS from their products and packaging. And we're talking about McDonald's, Apple, Home Depot, Amazon. So this is a monumental shift, right? I mean, I think that all of these individual state-level measures and the lawsuits filed in places like Hoosick Falls could eventually push us towards a tipping point where developing alternatives, safer alternatives to PFAS, is so much more lucrative than continuing to use them. So market forces actually are regulation moves slowly, markets move fast.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
I think this all has the potential actually to be much more effective than regulation. But what needs to happen is we need to turn off the tap because these chemicals are going to be in the environment, you know, when our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and their great-grandchildren are born. The ones that are currently in the environment are going to be out there forever. So we need to turn off the tap so at least the levels can stabilize and possibly decline.
You write in your book, given the staggering scale of the problem, the burning question becomes, what can any of us do about it?
Yeah.
What do you tell people who ask you this question?
In that part of the book, I talked about litigation and, you know, larger steps people can take. But I think for all of us, there are small steps we can take in our own lives to protect ourselves. And one very simple thing you can do, all of us can do, is filter our drinking water. You know, at this point, we know that at least a third of all people in the United States are relying on water that's contaminated with PFAS, and the number is going to be much larger. The systems that are recommended for, you know, people who don't live in highly contaminated communities are under-sink reverse osmosis or under sink systems that have multiple stages involving carbon. So I know that's a bit technical, but it's important. And I would just say there's a certification. Look for NSF certification 53 or 58, because those have been independently certified to remove PFAS from drinking water.
By NSF, that's the National Science Foundation? Is
yes.
Is that what that is for?
Okay. Yeah, so there's an independent body that has certified those filters. In terms of consumer products, you can avoid buying products that are marketed as waterproof or stain resistant. Mm. Another thing people can do is look for what are called Proposition 65 warnings. So the state of California has a law that requires manufacturers to put a warning on products that contain certain toxic chemicals. There are other resources you can consult to try to figure out which products are safe, which products are less likely to contain these chemicals. So the Environmental Working Group has what's called the Skin Deep database, and you can look up the chemical contents of various cosmetics. There's an organization called Momovation that's been commissioning studies on all kinds of consumer products for PFAS. So they've looked at condoms, toilet paper, Band-Aids, plastic sandwich bags, contact lenses, makeup, and butter wrappers. And there's PFAS in some brands of all of those products. So,
oh,
but they
wow.
will, they actually specifically name names, tell you which ones do and do not have PFAS in them. For cooking and food storage, use natural materials whenever possible. So stainless steel, cast iron, glass, and ceramics. That protects you from toxic chemicals in general.
Mm-hmm.
And this may seem like a bit of an odd one, but avoid eating locally caught freshwater fish. So those have been...
Ooh, that's a big one. Yeah.
Freshwater fish have been found to be a major contributor to PFAS in human blood. So eating a single serving of locally caught freshwater fish can increase your blood levels as much as drinking highly contaminated water for an entire month.
Oh my goodness. Wow. That's shocking.
Yes.
Wow.
Eggs from backyard chicken coops can also be a major source of exposure because the feed is made from fish meal.
Wow. Oh, wow. These are all really good tips. Things that people wouldn't expect.
Yes.
Is there anything that you could name off the top of your head in your own life that you have changed as a result of your reporting?
All of the things on this list, I do. And I really annoy my 14-year-old son because if we go out to a restaurant, I ask for a glass instead of a plastic glass. But, you know, I use all of these resources. I try to protect myself and my family by doing my research, and that's really all any of us can do.
Mm-hmm. Mariah, thank you so much for telling us about your reporting.
Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
You can read They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals by Mariah Blake on Apple Books. We'll include a link to it and some of the resources she just named on our show notes page.